From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? We should know the answer to that question by now, one would imagine. Joining me, as always, from London, the captain himself, Giles Morgan. Come in, Giles.
Hey, Grant, how are you doing?
I am doing extremely well, thank you very much. Extremely well. Life is good. I'm COVID-free. I had the test. I had the swab stuck right into my brain. And I'm officially
COVID-free. What did they discover?
Well, it was just from inside my head, it was just a rattling noise that I heard. I don't know what they found. Also joining us, hopefully, from somewhere adjacent to or maybe in the lake, is Roger Mitchell. Roger, are you there?
I am. How are you? Why were you doing the test in the first place?
Well, listen, you get bored after being locked down for a while. It's like I've run out of things to do. I've gone all the way through Netflix. I've reached the end of the internet. Why don't I go and get a swab shoved up my bugle? The first person I've seen in 3 months called me the day after I had a beer with him to say, mate, I'm really sorry, I've tested positive for COVID and I've got to call everybody, like having an STD.
All right.
So I had to go and get a test and I was negative, as I figured I would be, but always good to know.
I thought it was just after the 3-0 turnover that you just thought, enough.
No.
I'm just going to knock myself out.
No, I just, he is persona non grata in the Cayman Islands. I'm sure there's a lot of people cursing him for the fact that swab shoved up their nose. Anyway, enough of swabs and noses and pandemics. Let's get on to the topic at hand, which is, of course, sport. And this week we have a rather special guest with us. Giles, why don't you fill people in as to who's going to be joining us shortly?
Yeah, it's very exciting, Grant. We've discussed COVID-19, coronavirus, wreaking havoc and uncertainty all over the sports world in every country. We've also discussed it's going to be very clear that there will be significant investment opportunities in the months ahead with distressed assets. And our guest this week is, I would say, he's a titan in the world of finance, but particularly in the world of sports finance. And it's a big pleasure to welcome Jerry Cardinale to the show. For those of you who don't know who he is, he's a founder and managing partner of Redbird Capital, which is a major private investment firm. And when I say major, I mean major, but with interests in Yankee Entertainment Sports Network and One Team and a whole lot more. He learned his trade, as so many of these fellas did, as a 20-year veteran of Goldman Sachs. He was a student at Harvard and then went up to Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. So in many ways, a CV that matches my own. And what a pleasure it is. To...
In many ways, it doesn't, Giles.
I'm trying to think of the similarities, but as we get him on the show, I have no doubt we'll find some areas of synergy.
Well, let's find out, shall we?
Jerry, a very warm welcome to The Big Interview, which is part of the Are You Not Entertained sports podcast series. Lovely to have you with us.
Great to be here. Great to talk to you guys.
And we'll get stuck in. We've got a million questions for you, but it's really good for us. We haven't had too many people from across the pond on our show yet, and we're very keen to get your perspective. But I wanted to start with a sort of easy one for you, just a nice sort of 7-iron just to get you warmed up. You've been involved in the world of finance for a long, long time, but you're also quite synonymous with the world of sports finance. What's your own sort of personal attachment to sport and as a fan or as a player of sport?
That's a good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before. But you know, when it comes to sports, it obviously it touches the soul of every individual who's involved in it, right? The passion. There's a passion there that if you're looking at it from a business standpoint, you always have to stop yourself a little bit and remember the passion side of it. So it's a very good question. you know, for me, I think I was always athletic growing up, but the real sport that really generated the passion for sports in general for me was rowing. And it also, you know, delivered a tremendous series of life lessons for me. And so, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia, which is a huge rowing town. And, you know, Philadelphia was, you know, and as far as rowing, it was known for the hometown of Jack Kelly, who was Grace Kelly's brother. And he was a working class bricklayer, I think. And he ended up, you know, breaking through all the barriers and winning a gold medal at the Olympics in the single scull. And, you know, it was just a tremendous story. And, you know, really put Boathouse Row in Philadelphia on the map. And then from there, I went on to Harvard and rowed at Harvard. And then was fortunate enough to my first real experience in Europe, sport, a European sport, was rowing at Oxford in the Oxford-Cambridge boat race. And so, you know, all the way through, I think rowing was a tremendous part of my life, you know, and unfortunately, I'm only close to 6 foot tall, so I don't I don't really have the build to really excel at rowing, but it was sort of the passion side of it that kept me going.
Jerry, just talk a little bit. You mentioned there some of the lessons that you learned from rowing. My youngest daughter was a rower when she was at school. So I've been the parent getting up at 5:30 to drive out to the river and do all the whole thing there. And I learned plenty of lessons. One is always have a thermos flask with you. But talk a little bit about some of those lessons that you learned from rowing, because it is an extraordinary sport.
It is, you know, and the thing about rowing is it's the ultimate amateur sport. You know, I remember growing up in Philadelphia and watching the people around us who were national team rowers going training, you know, all year round for the Olympics and for the World Championships. And they were holding, you know, jobs on the side because they, you know, rowing just doesn't really pay anything. And, you know, that is, I always thought it was the ultimate amateur sport because you're doing it for the proverbial love of the game.
Yeah.
You're not doing it for the sponsorship or the marketing. You're not going to get some big Nike contract. You're doing it for literally, you know, in the old days, the old Coliseum, you know, paradigm that, you know, for the love of the game, love of the fight. And so that's, I'd say there's something in that purity that I start with as a lesson that, you know, no matter what, you know, in today's world, you know, it's all about the money. And sometimes you got to stop yourself and say, hey, you know, it can't just be about the money. Maybe it's, you know, when you're on your deathbed looking back in life, you know, it would be a shame if it was only just about the money. And so I like that. I like that as a starting point for rowing. You know, the second lesson is really was taught to me at Henley. When I was at Harvard, we competed at Henley. And I remember, you know, in America, you would have the six lane races. And at Henley, you have two lane races and you're very close together. And on either side, there are these railroad ties or these large pieces of wood. And you're really cooped in there side by side. And I remember my coach at Harvard saying, you know, you guys, when you go over to Henley, you're going to, for the first time, really understand what it means to compete mano a mano, because you're going to be so close to each other going down that course, and you're going to look over at your counterpart in that other boat, and you're going to be dying. Your legs are going to be burning. Your lungs are going to be burning. You're going to want to quit. And that's when you are, for the first time, you're going to come face to face with what kind of man are you? And are you going to break, or are you going to break the other guy? And it starts to really, that was really an eye opener for me. And that has stuck with me, you know, ever since. And then the final lesson was one that, you know, I also learned, probably more so in my Oxford days, which was when you step back and you look at rowing, what's interesting about it is that you're actually going backwards down the course.
Yep. Yeah.
And what that enables you to do is that enables you to see everybody's stroke, because the way you look at everybody's stroke is you look at the puddle that the blade makes when it goes through the water. And if you pull hard, it is a certain type of puddle. And if you decide to take off and not pull so hard, it's another type of puddle. And so what's amazing about rowing is that you can see in the course of a race who decided to pull and who decided not to pull, who, you know, took the easy way out and who didn't. And at the end, you pull that boat up to the dock, and there's some very uncomfortable conversations that you have with your teammates who basically say to you, hey, what happened there? What was that all about? And you can't get away from it. You can't hide it. And I always thought that was the coolest thing in the world because, you know, talk is great. But at the end of the day, are you there for your team or are you not? And I love that. I thought that was that's what made rowing just so and continues to make rowing such an amazing sport.
Jerry, that's a wonderful start. And there's something you mentioned there that I think may become a bit of a theme of our conversation. It's something that I've got involved in the last few years and noted, which is the difference between how sport is viewed in America compared to Europe. And my theory, and then I'd obviously love your view, is that in America, sport was always conceived as professional and as a business, whereas in Europe, as you rightly allude to, it started as amateur, as Corinthian. People look at professionals sometimes down their nose. And I think that is one of the big challenges for all the American owners coming to try and invest in European sport is that, you know, one phrase that I think would sum it up for me, over here a lot of people say, well, you're not really ever the owner of a franchise or a club. You're just the custodian and then you'll move on. And how do you think that the American investor or owner will ever get their head around the different European culture?
Yeah, look, that is a great question. And it's one that I, as I've been spending more time in Europe and looking at bringing our type of investing to the European sports landscape, I would tell you the first thing that comes to my mind is exactly that divergence. And, you know, I'd say that no matter whether you're in America or you're in Europe, you have to have a respect for the fan. You have to have a respect for the community and civic obligation that team owners have to the community in which they play. And I'd say that connectivity to the to that civic duty is so apparent in Europe. I look at the European landscape and I say, you know, what's really interesting here is that the fans really own the team. And you as an owner or prospective owner, you better get religion around the fact that the fans own the team and that you are just simply a caretaker coming through at this moment in time. You've gotten the proverbial baton and you have an obligation to do right by those fans. You have an obligation to put a winning team on the field. You have an obligation to create value propositions for the fans to enhance the way that they experience their team. And what's interesting is that, you know, that does exist in America very much so. I mean, in America, you have multi-generations of fans where there is a ritual from an American orientation, you know, and baseball is a classic example of this, where, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, in the summer, you know, a grandfather and his son and his son's son, you know, go to a baseball game, and it's a great 4-hour experience, and it's a ritual, right? It's something that is such a core to family values in America, and you know that hasn't gone away. But what's challenged it is money and technology. You know, business, sports in America has become big business. And some of, you know, and as a result of that, there's such a greater need for better infrastructure. And many of the seats that fans have had for multi-generations get priced out of their capability to pay for them. And that makes it tough. And so I know that there's a lot of debate in American sport that, you know, there's got to be a balance where you have to grow, you have to keep fueling the evolution and development in sport to continue to provide the value proposition to the fan, particularly in a world of technology advancement where the competition for eyeballs has never been greater. And sports is coming up against video games, it's coming up against esports, it's coming up against, you know, sitting at home and watching video on demand, right? And so there's got to be a value proposition there. And so that value proposition is going to entail bringing money into the game and continuing to provide better services for the fan. But that can't come so much so at the expense of that, you know, the grandfather, the father, and the grandson being priced out of, you know, this multi-generational experience. So it's going to require some self-regulation, I think, as well as an embracing of, you know, continuing to, you know, push the value proposition forward.
You mentioned baseball there, which is of course America's pastime, and you know, people like me that look at things like Field of Dreams, and I think that completely encapsulates what you've just said. You look at baseball, and somebody can see some contradictions in terms of value proposition. I mean, baseball's losing quite a bit of money. You have an aging demographic, quite a badly aging demographic. But then, Jerry, at the same time, when the Mets come up for being bought, you've got everybody and their dog looking at it, at valuations of the franchise that would blow your socks off. How do you square all those elements around? Because I'm really struggling to understand who's right here. Is it losing money, or is the value going up more and more and more?
But the answer is both. I think it's challenged right now as a sport, but the value, the asset value, the is still very much there. You know, no matter what the challenges are in sport across any league and any team, you know, it is still, in my view, the best must carry content in any city, in any region of a country. And you just can't get around that. You know, in the old paradigm, it was, you know, sports was the one thing that wasn't TiVo-able, right? And yeah. So I'd say that the asset values, I believe there is still very much intrinsic value and very much a floor in those asset values that can be substantiated. Where the disconnect comes is really that you're talking about is in two things. Number one, how that content gets monetized, and particularly in a world of changing technology for distribution, and in a world of change where the underlying demography is changing. You said, and you were right, that it's an aging demographic. Well, you know, one of the biggest challenges for sports is that the young people today want to consume content differently than the way it's been consumed. You know, to sit through a four-hour game for some of the young people today, when they have been weaned on 30-second sound bites of, you know, where you can get news immediately, and everything is reduced into shorter periods of time where you're much more peripatetic in terms of the variety of a la carte content that you can get, that makes it very challenging. And so sports has had, at least in America, you know, sports has had to really step back and say, okay, we can't just keep doing things the way we've been doing it. We know we have the best must-carry content that's out there. It's not a question of that being, you know, in question. It's really a question of how do we evolve in delivering that content to our fan base that is aging and the new fan base coming up wants to receive it differently. And that's, you know, look, with that, I ought to say, with that will come tremendous opportunities. And so I'm very optimistic about that in sport, but it's going to require, you're definitely going to go through a period here where you're going to see this disconnect that you rightly pointed to in terms of the actual P&L versus the intrinsic value on the asset side.
Jerry, we've talked about data before, and I wondered, I've got a question for you. You as a finance guy, do you think sport knows its audience well enough yet? I mean, we talk about
eyeballs.
Right. So do you think that's one of the inherent problems, is actually knowing the consumer and knowing the habit, knowing the geography, socioeconomics, all the rest of it? Is that one of the barriers to entry at the moment, or not entry, but to success, is just simply not knowing the diaspora well enough?
Yeah, look, I'd say what you're getting at is a very important point, which is that the thing that has always confounded me. Look, I invest not just in sport. A lot of the stuff that we do that gets the most notoriety is the sports stuff. But I invest in, you know, communications, I invest in financial services, I invest in energy, et cetera. And that gives me an ability to look very unemotionally at sports and see trends and make comparisons to other businesses. I think the most important thing you can do as you start to figure out how to answer the question you just asked, is to not take the passion thing we just talked about for the first part of this discussion and put that aside for a second and say, okay, now let's look at sport as pure business. These are all, many of these teams and leagues are mini Disneys. These are multinational entertainment companies. And what I find, the disconnect that I find is that for some reason, and I know the answer and I'll get to it, sport tends to not monetize their fan the way other industries would monetize their customers, yeah, who they have captive to them.
Yeah.
You know, sports, you know, in sports, they rarely follow their customer, i.e. the fan. They rarely follow them in and out of the stadium or the arena. And what's amazing about that is, unlike many other industries, sport has their customer base captive to them for a certain period of time, 2 hours, 4 hours, whatever it is. And yet they don't, you know, there's the challenges, in fairness to sports. You know, one of the things I learned is that, you know, with the proliferation of technology, one would think that as you're a fan sitting in your seat in that stadium or that arena, teams would have not only gotten your, you know, email and your cell phone number, but they would have gotten your, you know, your buying behavior, and they'd be able to push monetization opportunities out to you. The challenge with that, and by the way, this is really going to accelerate with the advent of gambling and betting.
100%.
But the challenge with that is if you're a team owner and a league, you do not want, think about this simple proposition. You do not want the fan sitting in that seat at a live event game, looking down at his phone or her phone. You want the fan looking at the playing that's going on in the field. So how do you balance that? Because if you had everybody looking down on their phone and transacting on the phone, which, by the way, the young generation today really kind of leans more towards than the older generation, it's going to change the dynamic of the live event. And so the answer is that, you know, I think sports is going to have to start to look at other industries and how other industries interact with their customer base and follow them in and out of the arena with which they interact with them on, and do it in a way that's appropriate, that's not overdone, that's not that continues to deliver a value proposition and a stickiness in that relationship. And then the nuance to sports is do that also such that it doesn't take away from the passion that comes about in the live event. Very, very difficult. I mean, these are not simple answers.
Terry, this is absolutely fascinating. And everything you've talked about there just makes so much sense. But I want to ask you, obviously, we've lived in an environment where sport has become more popular, more global, more expensive, as you've described. And now we kind of seem to be hitting a moment in time where, on the one hand, sport, as you say, is seeing a huge influx of smart people like you from the business side that understand the opportunity there. But at the same time, you've got the fans now globally going through a moment where they're all going to be struggling. And the high cost of sports, which you touched on your first answer, is really going to start to bite. And so you've got this tricky dichotomy where, on the one hand, you have an extraordinary opportunity to squeeze more from the fans, as you talked about. But at the same time, you've got to be very, very careful in doing that because they're under an awful lot of pressure. How do you balance that? Going back to that thing you said about, you know, loyalty to the fans and understanding that you're a custodian, because for a lot of business people that come in and look at these sports franchises as the cash cows that they undoubtedly are, you have to balance that with that idea of custodianship and stewardship and looking after the fan, which necessarily is going to reduce the amount of profit available. So how do you mentally go about juggling those two things?
Yeah, a couple things on that. One is from the sports team and league perspective, I think they have had, despite the tremendous tailwinds that I'd say sport in general has had over the last 20 years, and there's no doubt when you look at how sport, from a pure valuation and business perspective, it's outpaced, you know, the S&P 500. If you were an investor in sport over the last 20 years, you've done extremely well. It'll be your best performing asset, maybe next to, you know, high-end art as an example. So it's done very well as an asset class. challenge. You know, I think you know, anybody in sport would tell you that they've had a little bit of a slight nuanced headwind coming their way more recently. And I think that's provided some sobering moments that, you know, despite everything that we've said, and I'm very bullish on sport, you know, things aren't always going to keep going up. And, you know, and I think with sport, valuations and the value of sport in the community and as a business proposition will continue to go up. The question really is, what's the slope of that curve? And is it plateauing, or can it continue to have the kind of trajectory that it has had for the last 20 years? That's really the question. And the challenge is, and where the slight, you know, and the slight headwinds may have been appearing, you know, more recently, is that there's, as I said earlier, there's just more competition for this content and the eyeballs that everyone wants to access. And the real challenge that I think we're, that sport in general, and other industries for sure, but sport particularly, is going to have to get through now is the COVID overlay. Because I think the live event, and I've been a big investor in the live event economy, I think the live event is going to be challenged for a while. And it does not mean that that's binary. It will definitely come back. And I'm very bullish on the live event, because at the end of the day, humanity is very much a social organism. And we crave human contact, and we crave human interaction, going back to that first thing we talked about passion. That's why sports is always going to be valuable. It's just basic human instincts and evolution. Having said that, I think people, despite that craving, are psychologically damaged a little bit from this pandemic. You know, I mean, you know, all of a sudden, for the first time, you're told you can't shake somebody's hand, you can't hug somebody when you see them. You have to be 6 feet apart from them. And so the question really is, you know, when it comes to sport and other live events like music, how do you get people together? When do you get people together? And that is taken what was, I think, some minor headwinds that were facing sports pre-COVID, which was this competition for eyeballs, you know, that you're seeing with changing technology and the way, you know, consumers want to consume content and the way their content is distributed to them. Really driven by, you know, if you want to largely define it, the FANG stock phenomenon, where you can sit at home and you can basically get everything streamed to you, and everything has now become a la carte. Or on the live event side, you know, technology's meant that has enabled you to, you know, no one anymore buys season tickets, you know, to these events, you know, because of technology in the form of companies like StubHub. You know, you can figure out what one or two games you may want to go to. You can buy just them and then not the rest of the season. Well, that is a big paradigm shift for sports teams and leagues, because in the old days, you know, a big part of the economics of sports teams and leagues was fans, these multi-generational fans that we talked about, buying season tickets. And you knew, you know, that was the underpinning of your P&L as a sport team or a league. You knew that you would have that annuity coming in year to year. And that changed dramatically because of technology. So, you know, those kind of things is what sport was facing going into COVID. But now COVID rate has accelerated much more the trajectory of those headwinds, I'd say, with a psychological overlay that's just going to take time. So for the next couple of years, I think these sports teams and leagues are just going to have to figure out how to adapt and pivot a bit in terms of the way they get their content to their fans. You know, I think there's going to be a heavier reliance on media than the live event. And certain leagues are going to have to adjust more than other leagues. There are certain leagues that have a healthy balance between media and ticketing revenue. There are other leagues that rely much more on ticketing revenue. And that's going to create some, you know, financial and liquidity issues for certain teams and leagues that they're just going to have to get through in the next couple of years.
Jerry, could I pick up on a couple of the topics that you mentioned there, because you're explaining and articulating so well so many of the issues. One of the ones that I'd like to mention was sport not being very good at maximizing the revenue per fan or on the jargon, average revenue per user, ARPU, which loads of other industries have really got their head around very, very well. You guys have invested in the regional sport network, yes, with the Yankees. And, you know, one would argue that you're right at the forefront of this, because sport in many ways has been a B2B business all through its existence. You sold your content to somebody else who then had the relationship with the end user. And now, as you say, tech is allowing you to have that relationship directly. Many people say that the regional sports network will suffer because of this, because, you know, maybe, you know, there'll be more people like Dish that decide to not carry it, or Comcast one day will wake up. Is YES really going to become very quickly a direct-to-consumer product, you think, Jerry?
Well, first of all, what I'd say to you is that nothing is a straight answer when it comes to these questions. These are a series of blurred lines and grays, not black and whites. And so, you know, when, you know, if you take, you've raised YES, the YES Network, as an example. You know, we created the YES Network with the Steinbrenner family and the Yankees and the owners of the New Jersey Nets at the time, back in 2001. And, you know, we handshook that deal and signed it September 10th, 2001, if you can believe it.
Wow.
By obviously that week was a horrible
week. An unusual
week.
Yeah.
Yes. And we had an obligation to be on the air by April of 2002. And we did it. And I'd say, if you remember back to 9/11 and the role that the Yankees played in getting New York through that period was phenomenal. I mean, it seared in my mind what we talked about earlier, which is the role of sport in the community. I mean, I'd say when George Bush came to Yankee Stadium and he put the Kevlar jacket on and he got up on the pitcher mound and he threw that ball, that first game ball out, that was the most unbelievable experience I've ever seen. I mean, that was better than 1,000 Star Spangled Banner, you know, songs. And so, you know, you fast forward though, when I retired from Goldman, we sold the YES Network to the Murdoch family and Fox, and they owned it from 2012 to 2017. And then Disney bought Fox. And, you know, I came back in and partnered with the Yankees and Sinclair Broadcasting and Amazon and bought the network back in partnership with the Yankees. The Yankees had stayed in it though, the whole time. And what's interesting there is that we added, you know, we had a traditional broadcaster in there in the form of Sinclair, but we added Amazon. Yep. And to your question, you know, I think that was really an important development because this thing about, you know, the way consumer, you know, you have two things hitting each other. You have technology is changing the way consumers want to consume this content. And you also have technology changing the way this content is distributed out to consumers. And what's in the middle of that is the question that nobody can answer right now, which is, well, what's the form? How is that going to get monetized? What's the economics underlying it? And we don't know. And so what we tried to do in YES is we tried to put the right partners at the table. And as usual, the Yankees are going to be first out in front of just about everybody figuring this out for the rest of the industry. And so, yes, I don't think it's binary in the way that you asked your question that, you know, that we're going to go from linear distribution to OTT immediately. It's going to be a mix of both. I would say, I think the negativity around the linear distribution model, I think, is a little overdone, only because, you know, MVPDs, the cable guys, the telco guys, the satellite guys, they're not just going to sit there and let the disruptors come in and completely take away their business.
No.
You know, they're going to have their own OTT products. And I think you're going to see that the linear distribution guys, the big thing that they have going for them that I don't see changing anytime soon is that they are the pure broadband pipe into the home. You want to get your internet, you got to go with those guys. Video is different. Your video gets bundled into that, and sports is a subset of that video content and product. And how that gets monetized is what's going to be in flux. And you'll have some people that are going to want to take the bundle. You're going to have other people who are going to want to separate out the bundle. And I think what you're going to see is that the cable guys, the linear distribution guys, they're going to be more open to that kind of flexibility to give the consumer access in the way the consumer wants it. And then it's just going to be a question of how do you re-underwrite the economics of sports content monetization. None of us know it. The bet I made, having started YES in 2001 and going through 9/11 and going through all the things that we went through, I was absolutely confident to partner again with the Yankees and our new partners to buy it back, because the one thing I got religion on in the close to 20 years that I've owned this or been involved with it, because I stayed on involved with it even after I sold it. The one thing I got religion on was that this is, as I said to you earlier, this is without a doubt the best must-carry content in the New York tri-state area. And yep. It's just a question now of how do we pivot and evolve and lead the industry in changing the way it gets monetized.
So let me come back to the second thing I wanted to ask about your previous answer, which was the question of unbundling, which I think is the great threat for sports. I come from the music industry where we had a product called a long player, where you had three hits and seven elements of filler, which, you can see the parallel with a season ticket where you've got four or five great games and a lot of games that maybe are not must see. And it's the same with sports channels where, frankly, people want to pick and choose exactly what they want to see instead of being shown maybe some sports that they don't like. This is going to lead to what are today called leagues, where you've got big teams and small teams, and that's the same in American sport, where the regional values kind of make the difference. And in Europe, you've got big teams that are more and more frustrated about having to share the pie with smaller teams. How do you see the unbundling, the inevitable unbundling in sport, playing out both in America and in Europe?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Look, I think, as I said, the evolution in sports is going to require, and this is really challenging, but I'll say it, is going to require an element of self-moderation. And so, the capitalistic tendencies that you just alluded to, where the big guys want to squeeze out the little guys, they don't want to they view themselves as subsidizing the little guys and the little teams, don't want to be pushed down. Everybody's going to have to step back and they're going to have to recognize the health of the ecosystem that enables them to do what they do is very important. So the big guys, I personally don't believe that the big guys would benefit more by pushing out the little teams. I really believe that there's a huge benefit to having a diversity of small and large, because, it mirrors different demographics in cities. And so you can't have, the challenge is, and from a pure business standpoint, the bigger cities should mean, and the wealthier cities should be able to, enable their teams to pay more to players, to then put better teams on the field, to then win more. But then, to what end? Because then, whatever happened to the underdog mentality in sports, where out of the blue, you have a Houston Astros or a Washington Nationals, come in and, win the World Series, where their payroll is one third of what the payroll is of a big market team. Well, that to me is more sport and the ethos of sports than, a bunch of big market teams outgunning each other with these crazy payrolls. I just think it's more, the former is more exciting than the latter. And it's certainly more true to the originality and authenticity of sports. Having said that, as usual, nothing is simple. It's not black and white. And so where I see this thing going is I do see an accommodation of both. I think you have to keep, I think there's a responsibility, in the same way that I believe there's a responsibility for team owners to embrace the fans and recognize that this is as much the fans' team as it is the team of the person who put the money in to buy it at that one moment in time. That's an element of self-moderation that the team owner has to respect that. There's no getting around that in my view, and you really got to respect it. And when you listen, I mean, you take the Yankees and you listen to Hal Steinbrenner, and his father, George, they always talk about the fan first. It's always about the fan. And that everyone's got to get religion around that. Same way, I think that the big market teams have to embrace the little market teams, and they have to realize that the underdog phenomenon is a hugely important part of sport. Maybe there will be an offshoot, you know, competition that could scratch the itch of some of these bigger market teams that give you another form of competition. But that you know, can't come at the expense of, you know, I know these things have been, it's been bandied about in Europe, in European football, but that can't come on a binary basis at the expense of the little teams. You've got to have the global, you know, competition across the landscape. And then if you want to experiment with maybe a super league competition or something else, there seems to be a lot of momentum around that. I just think that will only happen if it doesn't come too much at the expense of the smaller market teams. So it's got to be a balance, and it's got to be self-moderated.
Jerry, fascinating. And shifting tack a little bit, but only a little bit. As you know, I used to work for an organization that was traded as the world's local bank for a while in its history at HSBC. And it seems to me in some sports, like certainly rugby union, which is a big sport over in certain parts of Europe and down in Australia and New Zealand, that there seems to be a sort of there's been a sort of focus on trying to be global and trying to be more internationalized, and it's perhaps caused a few ships to sail close to the rocks. As an American, but someone who's an internationalist, what's your view on the global versus the big regional versus the big local within the sort of sports investment area? Is big always good, or can sports exist and not always sort of pursue the sense of global domination?
I think I probably will end up taking more of a contrarian view on that question. And it's come up a bunch, because if you're in the business of sports as I am, you know, there's an inertia that pushes you towards finding new forms of growth and new avenues of growth. And in America, as an example, you know, the very facile thing to reach for is global, taking a sport global, particularly, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, the prospects of China, particularly coming out of the Beijing Olympics and the run up to that. And in fact, even with the NBA in America, people say that, you know, it has a lot of tailwinds and has really emerged as, you know, one of the top, if not the top league, neck and neck with the NFL in America. And, you know, well, they say one of the reasons for that, obviously the economics around the NBA, they just got it right. But also that they say it's probably the one American sport that's truly global. And when they say truly global, I think what they're talking about is really Europe and Asia. I mean, you know, there's European leagues, but there's also Chinese and other Asian leagues. And you can't really have that as much. You can't really have that with football as much. You have Europe, and it's harder in Asia just by the nature of those demographics, and baseball sort of in the middle. And so I've taken a different view, and I have, until recently, you know, resisted the urge to go offshore, and because I believe that with all the changes that we talked about that need to happen for sport as the best must-carry content in a locality to continue to be on its trajectory that it's been on for the last 20 years, there's more than enough to do in your existing region, in your existing locality. You don't need to go offshore to drive growth and everything else. And so I actually take a different view. My view is that whole globalism thing is, I understand it. It's not unique to sport. Every industry, you know, talks about it and looks at it, but it's easier said than done. I think it's a lot harder to actually monetize that and put that into practice. And I think whether that is true or not, I come back to the converse, which is that there's more than enough to do to evolve in the current changing technology and demographic landscapes, as we discussed, that will keep you more than, if you pay attention and you stick to your knitting in your locality, you'll have more than enough to do to drive value. And if the international stuff happens, great, but it's not essential.
Jerry, you talk about international stuff there, and you have some investments in Europe, particularly in French football. Talk a little bit about how that came about and the plan behind that, because French football, to me as an Englishman, obviously, and Roger as a Scotsman, at the moment, it's very much the kind of poor relation of the Premier League, obviously, even La Liga and the Bundesliga. French football is not kind of uppermost in most European fans' radars. But so what's the opportunity there and how did you get involved?
Well, look, yeah, as I said, most of my career in sport has been spent in North America. And, you know, as I've evolved from monetizing the media rights with Yes to monetizing the infrastructure with Legends Hospitality to monetizing the live event itself with On Location and the NFL and the Super Bowl to now monetizing or partnering with the unions and the players' associations to help them, you know, grow as partners to leagues and teams, which they are. You know, that whole trajectory that spanned the last 25 years of my career had one common denominator to it, which is that we were partnering with world-class rights holders and we were creating great terminal value businesses around those rights holdings. What's interesting about European football, and I've been looking at European football now for the last 4 years, and I've been learning and I've been studying and I've been watching, which is why I have an appreciation now for the role of the fan in European football and the role of European football in its community coming from America and being very open to the differences and embracing those differences. The difference for me in Europe is that I can tweak my model, my investment model, which has been very successful for me for the last close to three decades, and become the rights holder myself. So right, in America, right. It's harder to be. It's in America, the rules are such; it's just harder to become the rights holder. That's changing, and you will start to see a change more by definition. You know, capitalism is Darwinian, and you know the rules that exist now in sports team ownership in America don't serve themselves as well for don't serve the leagues as well and the teams as well if they want to see that continued linear progression in asset valuations. And so they're going to have to change. And more and other types of capital are going to need to be allowed in. And so that's going to happen. And I'd like to be at the forefront of that for sure. But in Europe, those rules don't exist. And I can as myself and as Redbird, I can come in and do everything that I've done for the last 30 years, which has been very successful on the business side of sports, bring that to European football. But then I can vertically integrate and I can be the rights holder and also, you know, take our approach and integrate it into player performance and on the field performance. And that's very exciting for me. So it's, to me, you know, the way I invest in sports is what served me very well is it's all a continuum. I think where you're going to start to see dislocations is where people just show up and have had no background in sports and think that they can just go do it. Yeah. And, you know, that's why I think you have different experiences from, you know, the owners. I mean, these valuations in sports, have escalated to such a degree that you have to be very wealthy individually to be able to buy a sports team today. And by definition, if you're very wealthy, it means that you've excelled in business for the most part, unless you've inherited the money. And what really is an eye opener for some of these owners is that they're rock stars in their individual business lines and industries, and then they come to sport and they're having a hard time with it. And the reason is that there isn't a one-to-one transfer in terms of your capabilities in one business in the corporate or industrial world and translating that over into sport. There are some complementary skill sets, but you know, sport is a real continuum game. You have to, you know, it's an ecosystem. You have to, you know, there's things that are very unique to it. And I have close to three decades of apprenticing with some of the best sports owners in America as their partner, as I said. And to be able to bring that now to European football excites me very much because now we have an opportunity to put it all together, right? We can be team owner. We have a real view on how we can try to enhance player performance, how we manage teams for cash flow in an efficient way, certainly in an ecosystem like European football where you've got the transfer market, and you've got the obviously the economic penalty if you're relegated. Being able to manage a team financially with great financial acumen in that kind of an ecosystem is a challenge, but one that I'm really looking forward to. And then, you know, the input of the business side of sports, being able to do what I do on the business side and put that together with that as well, which also will feed into better cash flow management, which feeds into, you know, having more liquidity and resources to put the best players on the field. That's very interesting to me. And so that's sort of the next real focus for me and for Redbird.
Jerry, following up from that, from two different perspectives, we normally are very friendly on this podcast, but we do like to throw the odd curveball. What you just said there, I think Jim Palotta probably said word for word about 6 or 7 years ago with Rome. He probably said something like, compared to the franchise valuations in the States, I'm getting this for a steal. I just have to be okay and I'm probably going to do a great deal. And now he is in dire straits and, you know, has thrown everything he knows at it, and it's been probably one mistake after another. The second thing, the second curveball would be this. Some of the pillars of European football that you mentioned there, one being media values, are going to be under significant pressure, because if you take France, you know, if Media Pro disappears, then you've probably only got one bidder in Canal Plus, and they're probably going to lowball the whole of the French league. And the transfer values that French football has done so well in selling its players overseas, I think everybody expects a recession in the transfer markets. So what I'm saying, and as I say in a prickly way, is one could make quite a good case that this isn't the best time to be investing in European football.
Well said. I would say the following. First of all, with regards to Jim, Jim's a friend, and I have to say, I think he really did an admirable job with Roma. I think Roma, he had some curveballs thrown his way that were not of his own making, and so my hat's off to him in terms of what he was able to do with that. He had all the right instincts and all the right initiatives, but as you say, you know, welcome to sports. Sports is just the ultimate curveball, right? And then your point on the media side in France is also a very good point, and one that I'm aware of. That's why I think you made my point very well, that I just think that new types of capital that has continuity in sport need to stay with it. I think that, you know, to have new capital that has had no continuity in sports just start to show up and throw money at sports, that's going to lead to some problems for the capital and maybe for the ecosystem, because it's not going to be rooted in what, for me, if you said to me, what is the most important rule that you require, or what's the one thing that underlies your investment thesis when you are constantly pushing the envelope in these different areas across the value chain in sports, I would tell you it is a sense of continuity. That when I did the players deal in America with the NFL and Major League Baseball, this one team partners, I don't think I could have done that if I hadn't had the experience with the NFL on location and the Super Bowl a few years earlier. And I don't think I could have done that if I hadn't partnered with Jerry Jones and his family and the Dallas Cowboys and Legends Hospitality. And I couldn't have done Legends Hospitality if I hadn't, you know, which I partnered Jerry Jones with the Steinbrenners and the Yankees. I couldn't have done that if I hadn't done the Yes Network. And so, you know, my ability to continue to invest and knock on wood successfully in sport over a close to 3-decade spans is because I radically embrace continuity. And my perspective and vantage point is not that this is balancing this moment in time, which the things that you just alluded to are moments in time. But because of the continuity I have, I can make a judgment on those risks and decide whether or not, you know, those risks are binary, or whether or not they're absorbable. And then I can also, by definition, skate better to where the puck's going, not to use a sports analogy, an American sports analogy, but very much what I do in sport investing is skating to where the puck's going. I try to make an informed judgment as to where is this going over the next period of time. And then I try to bridge that. And so I definitely agree with what you said. But I don't look at those as binary risks. I look at those as risks where I can come in, and because of the capabilities that I can bring, which go way beyond just capital, that I can help be a catalyst for solving some of those and lowering the amplitude and that volatility, which definitely exists. There's no doubt. Last thing I'll say to you, there is no doubt. And I think we've talked about it in this conversation. Sport today is tremendously risky. People don't seem to, I don't get the sense that people really understand that.
They don't.
Because, you know, I get the sense that, you know, I've always said that, you know, sports is for the last decade has been like the new Hollywood, and everybody wants in and everybody's throwing money at it and everything else, but it's incredibly difficult. You have to be unemotional about it. You have to look at it as a business. You have to be sensitive to other things, intangibles like the fans and your community obligation. And then there's stuff that happens out of your control, and you've got to make sure you set yourself up such that you can absorb those hits and still survive.
Jerry, it's Giles here. I think that the last 15 minutes I've been silenced, which the guys will know is a rare thing, which is says an awful lot about the wisdom that you've spoken about. And I think what you just said, particularly now, sport is risky and has been for years. And in the last 3 or 4 months, obviously with the coronavirus and COVID, the global society has been rocked right to the core. And yet there is, it's so heartening, I have to say, so heartening to know that one, that you believe not just passionately in sports as a fan, but as the opportunity in commerce for sport, with all of the lessons you've learned along your career. But I also would say, and I hope this doesn't sound too obsequious, I think many of our listeners will feel a great sense of reassurance that there are people like you who are fans of sport, who are passionate about sport, who understand the nuances of the fan journey and the fan expectation, and yet also want to look to investment to preserve sport for the longer term. So on behalf of all of our listeners, actually, as well as obviously myself and Grant and Roger, thank you so much for coming on, because to get a view from New York is always fascinating, but to get a view from someone who has so much experience is a real privilege for us.
Well, thank you. It's been great talking to you guys. You guys ask great questions. You guys obviously have your finger on the pulse of all the hot button issues in sport. And I would just say, you know, for you as well as your listeners, I would just emphasize again that indeed, you know, I think sport is in a we're all in a challenging time right now, but sports has never been better positioned. It will be ultimately very resilient. And it is the best content that, you know, humankind has created. And I'm very bullish on it. And I just feel that, you know, guys like us have a role and a duty to get it through these periods of volatility. And we'll endeavor to do that.
Well, the fact that sport itself can be a comeback story is, I think, is heartening, right? Because that's what we all love about sport.
Yes. The underdog.
Well said.
Jerry, thank you so much, because this has been an extraordinary conversation. And as Giles said, just echo that. It was very gracious of you to come on, and you've been fantastic. So thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely.
It was just fun. A lot of fun, guys. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. Bye-bye.
Well, there we go. Wasn't that something, gentlemen?
That was amazing. You know, you can see from the background and the CV, the total quality, just the top of the top, the cream of the cream of the cream, spoke beautifully at the start about, you know, the values of the fan, and he spoke beautifully about not breaking away into Hollywood clubs and keeping the underdog culture. He spoke about the legacy, father to son stuff. Honestly, I think that was one of our best episodes, guys. I was delighted.
Yeah, it's funny. As someone who's spent a career in finance, I totally understand the acres of bad press that quote unquote bankers get. Because let's face it, there are a lot of scumbags in the world of finance. However, I've been very fortunate in my career to come across a lot of guys like Jerry, and along with all those scumbags, there are some of the most extraordinary brains that you'll find anywhere in the world. And you know, finance attracted the smartest people for several decades because that was where they'd get paid. So you find that bankers are chemists and physicists, and you know, all kinds of skills that they have that's just led them into finance. But you know, guys like Jerry really stand out, and it's why they've been successful. And so you know, to have someone that thinks that clearly and can articulate a strategy and an understanding of an industry so well was fantastic. I loved every second of that.
Well, and as I said, I think we've talked and lamented and pontificated and worried and fretted that the sports industry is not always on the direction we'd like it to be on. And who are we to necessarily have all the answers? But to hear someone like that talk about the sport in the way that I think 99% of sports fans would understand to a greater extent, it feels like more of that and the sports journey will continue in the right direction.
Marvellous. Well, gents, I guess that wraps it up for another week. All that remains is to thank you for listening. Hopefully you've enjoyed that as much as we obviously have. Please do...
If you don't, you're listening to the Rod Podcast, go somewhere else, because it doesn't get any better than that, trust me.
Nicely done, Rog. Yeah, sod off the lot of you.
Look. that could leave the three of us and our families.
So, please, if you get a moment, do take a second to rate and review us in the iTunes store. It really, really does help make the podcast more visible and help us build the audience. We would appreciate that enormously. Follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word, A-R-E. You can follow me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you can follow me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71. And a shameless plug for the next guest on the captain's table is Lord Sebastian Coe, who I think will also provide an interesting insight into the world of international sport.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, adieu.
Adieu.
Bye.